Iowa's rich soil has made it an ideal place to grow plants and an ideal place to grow and train horticulturists. This hour, we'll profile some of our most gifted and influential horticulturists. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. But since this is also the last day of Iowa Week, we're going to spend the hour exploring the stories of some of the people who changed the way we grow things. We'll start with the roses of Griffith Buck, then Sewell Foster, a Muscatine farmer who helped create Iowa State University, the apples of Spencer Ambrose Beach, and the far-reaching accomplishments of George Washington Carver. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, but this week we are doing something a little bit different. All week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we've been celebrating Iowa Week with the stories of remarkable Iowans. So this hour, we're going to focus on the lives and accomplishments of gifted and influential horticulturists who were educated or trained in Iowa or came from this state. Next week, of course, Richard Geron will be back to answer your questions. The first man we're going to talk about today may have developed the roses that are growing in your yard right now. Griffith Buck was at Iowa State University from 1948 through 1985, and he's credited with developing more than 85 varieties of roses. He passed away in 1991, and his daughter, Mary Buck, is here today to tell us about him. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Your father grew up in Rockford, Illinois, and his interest in roses grew out of an assignment that he got in high school to find a Spanish pen pal. Tell me what happened.
Well, to pass Spanish, he had to correspond with a Spanish student, and they could get names through the YMCA for 25 cents. Well, this was back in 1931, so you know 25 cents wasn't easy to come by. Well, anyway, he tried twice with names through the YMCA and didn't get any response. And he happened to be in the library looking, as he called it, at a book of pretty pictures and found the name of Pedro Dote, a Spanish rose hybridizer. So Dad took it on himself to write Señor Dote asking if he knew of a high school student that would be willing to correspond with him. And when the letter came from Señor Dote, as Dad read it, it was going to be Mario Antonio, his nephew. But when the letter came from the high school student, it was from Maria Antonia, his niece. And Dad, every time she would write, her uncle would send along little things like, when you breed roses, you're seeing something that no one else has seen before. And I think that and Dad's own curiosity got him started.
So it was asides in letters that came from his Spanish pen pal that,
yes,
that really planted those seeds for him.
Yes.
And he maintained a close relationship with the Dote family for many years, right?
Well, he and Maria Antonia corresponded up until the Spanish Civil War when it became too dangerous for her. But then it started up again in the mid-1970s when Simone Dote, Pedro's son, wrote Dad a letter with an understock question. And so Dad wrote back and he asked about Maria Antonia, and that started the correspondence up again. But unfortunately, she died about 2 years before Dad and Simone started corresponding.
Wow. Well, your dad went on to be a teacher, and he served in the U.S. Army 14th Airborne during World War II. After he left the service, he went to Iowa State College, and he entered the horticulture department. Had horticulture been something that he had been thinking about all along?
Well, he said one time that he thought if he was a horticulturist, everybody said the world was going to pot, and if he was a horticulturist, he could grow something to put in the pot. So,
so when he got to Iowa State as a student, do you know when his interest in roses really started to gel?
Well, he had wanted to study under Professor Tom Maney. Professor Maney had carried on the work of Dr. Nels Hansen and Professor Budd. But unfortunately, Professor Maney died in November before Dad got out of service in December of 1945. But He came on to Iowa State, and it was in 1949 when he started hybridizing.
And his work quickly turned to not just finding cold hardy roses, but also disease resistant roses. But that wasn't his first goal.
Well, his first goal was the hardiness. He wanted roses that people could use in landscape, that they didn't have to have all the winter protection. And the disease resistance and all came along kind of as a sideline to the cold hardiness.
And I've read that part of the reason that the disease resistance came along was that he didn't have much of a budget. So he actually had to develop disease-resistant roses because he couldn't spray them.
Well, and his method of going for the cold hardiness, the disease resistance, and all of it, he'd plant the seedlings out in the test plots and just let them be. And if they survived, that was good. And if they didn't, well, that took out the weak ones.
He described one of his early successes, a rose called Applejack. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because he has a wonderful story about the odor of that plant.
Well, Applejack was one of the early ones, and it's probably the biggest of the roses. It's nothing for it to get 7 by 7 feet. A lot of the early roses were 10 to 12 feet high and 12 to 15 feet across, so he had to work on downsizing. But Applejack was one. He was out in the rose plots, and it was a warm, humid June morning, and he could smell this decidedly apple fragrance. And so he got to tracking it down, and here was this rose bush that had sweetbriar rose in its background. And it was the sweetbriar genetics that was providing the foliar scent, the apple scent, and then it was covered in semi-double pink blooms just full of clove scent. And it was between the two, it chased him out of the rose plots. It was so strong.
and that he considered to be a success.
Mm-hmm. Applejack is cold hardy clear two-thirds of the way up in Manitoba. So it's
wow.
One of the early successes on hardiness.
He developed so many different kinds of roses. He's credited with 85 varieties. I get the impression that he probably created even more than that. For people who don't know a lot about roses, can you try to sum up his accomplishments for us?
Well, he was working for lazy man's roses. Roses that didn't take a lot of winter protection, that didn't take a lot of spraying, and yet still gave people the flower form of roses and lots of colors. For a long time, he joked you could have any color you wanted in his roses as long as it was pink. But in the early 70s, he started getting some other colors, the reds and the yellows. But he wanted roses that could be used as landscape plants, not as something in a specialized rose bed.
And he also developed a blue rose.
Well, it's technically blue lavender, but it's the bluest of the naturally occurring blue roses.
Wow.
Roses don't have the gene for delphinidin, which is what gives the blue color to plants. And they've tried gene splicing it in Australia to get a true blue rose, but the plants die. There's something lethal about the delphinidin gene.
When you were growing up, what kind of interaction did you have with your dad and his roses?
Oh, we'd go sometimes with him out to the rose plots. He had a lot of roses at home, and you just kind of pick it up from being around. My cousin tagged along one day, and that kind of gave us the name of what Dad did when he was hybridizing, because she said she watched Uncle Griff play bee.
Oh, that's wonderful. And he has also left behind a few writings about naming of roses, because when you develop that many different kinds of roses, of course, you have to come up with names for all of them. And he clearly had a wonderful sense of humor about it.
Well, he wanted things that reflected Iowa. Iowa's a prairie state. Iowa's an agricultural state or country state. And so he has several of them named with prairie in the name. There's several with country. Things that happened around, like barn dances, square dancer. He used some square dance terms as Allemand Ho, and then he also named them for friends. He had a variety of ways of naming them, but he started out wanting things for Iowa.
Did he ever ask you for help?
No, but since Dad passed away, my mother, sister, and I've managed to find names for about 20 more roses.
Oh, wow. And I did notice looking through the list that one of his roses is named for one of my predecessors on Iowa Public Radio, Dorcas Speer, who used to work for WOI Television and WOI Radio a long time ago. He has a Dorcas rose.
Yes, and that's named for her. She was really excited about it.
I'll bet she was. So when your father left Iowa State University, I know that there were some difficult things about that and that a lot of his breeding stock was destroyed. But there are some wonderful collections of your father's roses around the state of Iowa. There is a collection at Ryman Gardens in Ames. There's a collection at the Iowa Arboretum in Luther. There's a collection at Benton Sport Gardens in Benton Sport, Iowa. Elko County Rose Garden. And there are a lot of these collections that remain, and of course a lot of these roses that are still being sold and being planted. Do you have a favorite place to go and think about your dad and his roses?
Not really. I mean, anytime you're around the roses, you're kind of thinking of Dad. And between Mom and I, we've probably got over 100 bushes, so I can just kind of go in my own backyard and...
What's your favorite kind?
Probably Earth Song's one of the favorites. And it's pink, and then there's Griff's Red, which is ruby red. And those are two of my favorites, but it's kind of hard to actually pick a favorite.
I'm sure it is. And I've been told that your backyard is pretty amazing.
Well, I don't know. It's got quite a few roses in it.
So if you had to sum up your dad's legacy for us, what would you say?
Well, it's kind of like one of the hybridizers that new dad said, let Mom know after he passed away. He said, well, he was a man ahead of his time because Dad was working for shrub roses 25, 30 years ago. And it's only been in probably the last 10 or 15 years that they've really hit popularity. Everybody now wants shrub roses because they don't take the care. And so I guess it's the legacy that of the shrub roses and the fact that other people have actually used Dad's work to go on.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mary Buck is the daughter of Griffith Buck. He worked at Iowa State University in many different capacities from 1948 through 1985. He has to his name at least 85 varieties of roses that he developed that were cold hardy, disease resistant, and of course, beautiful. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about other influential and remarkable horticulturists who were from Iowa or who trained in Iowa or who really changed the way we grow things in this state. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and this week we're celebrating Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. So naturally, with Horticulture Day, we are talking about some of the most influential and remarkable horticulturists in Iowa history. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk about the life and work of George Washington Carver. With me now, though, in the studio is Donald Lewis, ISU Extension entomologist. He's also president of the Iowa Arboretum. Hi, Donald.
Good morning, Charity. Glad to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. And Charles Hall is with us. He is emeritus professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and he's written the history of horticulture at Iowa State University as well. Hello, Charles.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the very important figures in horticulture history in Iowa was actually somebody who helped develop Iowa State University and make it a place to educate people about growing things. And his name was Sewell Foster. He came to Iowa in 1836 to the town we now call Muscatine. Charles, tell me a little bit about him.
Well, excuse me. I was... fascinated in the early history of land-grant universities because of a discussion that went on as who was first as a land-grant university in the United States. And there was several reasons for that, because some of the universities, like Michigan State, was teaching, but they were not land-grant universities at that stage. But it came down to the final decision of who was first was through the efforts of Sewell Foster. And I consider Sewell Foster one of the greatest promoters of education, and I think he was responsible for the establishment of Iowa State University, Iowa State College at that time, because Iowa was not a state until the 29th, as the 29th state, December 28th, 1846. Well, he came on the picture in 1836, mm-hmm. but in 1856, he was writing for the Iowa Farm Journal. Well, at that time, it was considered that the farmers' publication. And when he proposed that Iowa must have a college for educating people in agriculture. And in 1858, the Iowa legislature, the General Assembly at that time, passed an act to establish an Iowa Agricultural College, which was signed by Governor Ralph Lowe on March 22nd, and they appropriated $10,000 to support Sewell Foster, who was appointed as the first Board of Trustees, and charter, which was, as chairman, which was developed and included the requirement that horticulture be taught.
So it really was Sewell Foster who paved the way for all of the horticulturists that we're talking about today to be
right.
educated and do their work at Iowa State.
That's right. And he established a nursery in what was Bloomington at that time, now Muscatine. There was Fountain Hill Nursery, and now is Fountain Hill City Park in Muscatine. But this effort that he made to get an appropriation for the establishment of a college that taught horticulture, and the college research and in a prairie in Ames, and with the college was selected in a prairie west of Ames, which the Morrill Act and the Land Grant College Act was passed on July 2nd, 1862, and on September the 11th, 1862, Iowa State was the first state to accept the provisions of the Land-Grant Act.
Let's move on and talk about some of the many horticulturists who came after Sewell Foster, and we will jump around a little bit, but I want to talk next about Spencer Ambrose Beach, who was an apple man. And Donald Lewis, maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit about him.
Well, my connection to this as an entomologist, of course, is that living here in Ames for the last 3 decades, I have frequently driven on Beach Avenue. Beach Avenue is the road that goes from sort of the southeast corner of campus near the Maple Willow Larch dormitories. It goes south down past C.Y. Stevens, down past the football stadium, and ends at Ryman Gardens. Beach Avenue was named for this famous horticulturist, Spencer Beach, who was only here for about 17 years, from 1905 to 1922. He had already established himself as an apple authority, an apple breeder, an apple specialist while he was working in the state of New York for the New York Ag Experiment Station. But when he came to Iowa State University in 1905, he was appointed head of the Department of Horticulture at that time, and he was also named a vice, an assistant dean in the College of Agriculture.
And he really came to Iowa State and came to Iowa because of the weather, like so many of us, right?
Well, I suppose he did. But just as with the Buck Roses, one of the problems with growing apples was you can't replant them every year. Somehow you have to have plants that will make it through the winter. And much of his research in the two northern climates that he worked was how do you get apple varieties that are winter hardy and still produce fruit that people want to eat, people want to buy. So his work with apples was very fundamental in establishing the apple industry around the United States. While he was at Iowa State, he developed 10 new apple varieties, which if you think about how laborious it is to be a bee pollinating roses to get new varieties of roses, that's what he was doing with apple trees, probably having to stand on ladders to pollinate flowers, to do the cross-pollination, to come up with apples that were good tasting, good looking, good producing, but then to cross those with trees that were also winter hardy.
And of course, we were talking earlier about the work with roses, and Griffith Buck had to be incredibly patient waiting for his roses to mature and to be able to crossbreed them. But I would guess that it takes even more patience to breed apples.
I assume so. All plant breeders have to be very patient people, and they start with thousands to tens of thousands of crosses, and then you plant the offspring of those crosses, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And with apple trees, you would probably have to wait at least 5 years to get your first crop before you knew if you had an apple that was even edible on those crosses that you had made. So as Charlie Hall can tell you with his breeding experiments with watermelons, you start with a lot of crosses and keep your fingers crossed that one of them will pan out.
And, of course, one of the, you mentioned 10 new apple varieties. One of his most, or perhaps his most famous, is called the Chieftain, which is still an apple that is grown and eaten and enjoyed by many people, a cross between the Jonathan and the Red Delicious.
Chieftain is a product of Iowa State University. We're very proud of that one and the legacy of apple breeders that we have had at Iowa State University to develop those. It has slipped a little bit in market share. It was a very good-tasting apple. It had a very firm flesh. It would store well. You could do lots of different things with it. It was a very popular apple for quite a period of time and one of my favorites when I was new here at Iowa State University.
Well, and after he died, the faculty of what was then Iowa State College passed a resolution saying that his labor and leadership has given Iowa and the world an outstanding collection of apple breeding material. Charles, can you tell me what you think his legacy is and how it continues today?
Well, we've left out one of the key links in his history, and that is that he came as a student of Professor Budd, who was the apple breeder and the person who imported a large number of horticultural plants, including apples, from Russia and other countries in order to bring about winter hardiness in the apple. And it turned out that so many of these were what we would call summer apples. They matured early and they wouldn't store. So he had propagated these and the growers grew them, but they wouldn't store. They would mature in August and early September and not as storage. So, but Professor Beach did his graduate work, his work with Professor Budd, and then he went back to Cornell and wrote books on the apples of New York and a number of other major publications. But Beach is one of his important achievements was he was leader and was first to establish the American Society for Horticultural Science, a national organization. And he and Liberty Hyde Bailey were the leaders of the American Society for Horticultural Science and was recognized for that. And he and Professor Budd trained a number of the North Central United States apple breeders and people who working with apple hardiness, and left a tremendous legacy in that area. And one of the things that I look back to Professor Budd today and these plants that he imported from Russia included apples, pears, cherries, and a number of others. But there's a pear tree, the experimental orchard for fruit breeding was what is now the Vinker Golf Course. And up in the hills where a lot of these apples were screened, there's a pear tree on, I think it's the 6th tee of Vinker Golf Course. That's one of Professor Budd's imports. It's an Asian pear, and it has fruit on it every year, and it's completely hardy and still there. So I see it when I play golf over there. In the fall, these people use a ball retriever and retrieve pears from as high up as they can reach that they're good.
Well, it's interesting, the names that keep coming up again and again, and not just today, but throughout the week, as we've also talked about conservationists on Talk of Iowa. We've talked about Professor Budd quite a lot. We've talked about Lewis Pamel also quite a lot. Can you give me an idea, Charles? The horticulture department at Iowa State University clearly became a center of research for many incredibly talented and devoted horticulturists. And there are many other great horticulture departments within the United States and around the world. But can you give me an idea of the standing of this department at that time when Professor Budd was bringing back all of these plants from Russia and as time went on?
It was the leader in the North Central United States and Canada. And one of his early students was from Quebec, Canada, who is Charles Gibbs. And he was one of the students that were involved with Professor Budd and Beach during that time. So they had a team of efforts, including Cornell University, Iowa State, the Canadian provinces in South Dakota, and the northern states. All of them were interested in winter hardiness as well as the qualities, the edible qualities of the fruits and storage and other things that were important to the production. But without the efforts of Sewell Foster back at a time when he was driving the issue of getting a college to teach agriculture, that foundation meant the difference in the long-term contributions that have been made through Iowa State University.
Well, and when we were putting this program together and we were asking our friends who appear regularly on Horticulture Day about people that they suggested that we might talk to, Donald You sent us a document that included 150 pages worth of information about different horticultures. I mean, the history of horticulture in Iowa is incredibly rich.
It is. And that document is just such an interesting story that in this lineage of famous horticulturists through Iowa State University, we go through Dr. Beach and Bud, and we come up to a professor named Harry Nichols. And Harry Nichols was famous in his own right, but one of the things he left behind was a manuscript that he wrote pretty much in longhand on yellow line tablets titled The Brief Biographies of Some of the Most Prominent People Who Helped Develop Iowa Horticulture. So he had written this historian that goes back to before, he had written this history that extends back before the Civil War. And it talks about some of the famous growers, the famous breeders, and so forth. And the Iowa Arboretum had the honor of publishing that biography written in 1975 in 2012, and it's still available for sale at the Iowa Arboretum.
All right. Well, Donald Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Donald Lewis is Iowa State University Extension entomologist and also president of the Iowa Arboretum. Charles Hall, thank you.
Okay, I would like to make one other comment.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you so much for being here today. Charles Hall is Emeritus Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. We'll be back from a short break in just a moment, and we'll talk about the life and work of George Washington Carver. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're wrapping up Iowa Week with the stories of Iowans who made remarkable contributions in the field of horticulture. The last man we're going to talk about today was not a native Iowan, but he came to Iowa looking for an education, and he couldn't have done what he did without the time he spent in our state. George Washington Carver was a botanist who revolutionized agriculture in the South. He came up with 300 uses for peanuts and many more uses for soybeans, pecans, and sweet potatoes. He was born into slavery in Diamond, Missouri. We don't know exactly when he was born, but he was likely born in January of 1864. And with me to talk about his life and his legacy is Diane Eilenstein. She's park ranger at the George Washington Carver National Monument in Diamond, Missouri. Hello, Diane.
Hi.
Well, let's start with that early life, because as I mentioned, George was born into slavery. But not only was he born into slavery, he was also kidnapped as a baby. Tell me what happened.
During the Civil War, Missouri was really a hotbed of guerrilla activity. There were a lot of outlaw gangs, individuals and groups that roamed the countryside and just terrorized the citizens. And on this property where George Washington Carver was living with his mother not long after his birth, he and his mother both were kidnapped or abducted and taken away by an unknown group, and we think that they were taken south from here, just a couple of counties south, and you're in the state of Arkansas, so they apparently headed south, and the man who was the owner of George and his mother, and his brother as well, named Moses Carver. Moses actually hired a man to search for them, and that man returned with just George. And so Mary disappeared that day. George lost his mother that day. He became an orphan on that day. So it was just a horrible crime and a terrible start to life for him.
And the story goes that he was probably recovered because he was such a sickly child.
Yes, and it's very uncertain exactly how it all happened, but whether he was sick when he was abducted or as a result of it, George Washington Carver was not expected to live as a child. He was very ill. He called it whooping cough, but we're just not sure. It seemed to be very severe, whatever it was.
Well, and you mentioned that George and his mother and brother were owned by Moses Carver and his wife, Susan. And this was right at the end of slavery, really, that George was a child. So after slavery was abolished, this remarkable couple decided then that they would raise George and his brother James as their own children.
Well, what happened was both of the boys were orphaned. They had never known who their fathers were and that a result of slavery. There were no legal slave marriages here at the time. And so the boys were raised without knowing their parents, and Moses and Susan, who were their original owners, then after the war became their caretakers and raised the boys here on the farm. That's correct.
But even after slavery was abolished, it was difficult for young African Americans to get an education, but that was something that George and his brother were able to pursue. How were they able to get educated?
George and his brother ended up growing up here on the farm, and we're not sure the Carvers themselves were literate. There's not much evidence to that, except that Susan Carver, Moses Carver's wife, had apparently some schooling. It appears that she had one of those Webster's Blueback spellers, and that George used that book here while he lived on the farm and taught himself what he could to read out of that book. So it started with some education, just training here on the farm. And then later, when the boys were old enough and were allowed to go up the road to the one-room school by the Carvers, they found the neighborhood did not accept them. So the schools by the mid-1870s were already segregated by race. But that was George's first attempt to go to school, and you may wonder why he was nearly 10 years old at that point. Why hadn't he tried before to go to school? And it's because of his illness. He was just too ill to leave the farm. And so when he went to the one-room school in the neighborhood, he found out, you know, like I often tell our students here, I say his first lesson in school was that he was not welcome. And so he came back home, apparently told the Carvers what happened, and it wasn't long until he decided to leave home to find a school that would accept him.
At the same time, you mentioned that he was not a healthy young man as he was growing up. That meant that he didn't do some of the heavier labor that his brother James could do. He spent a lot of time in the kitchen and in the house, but he also spent a lot of time in the woods. Tell me about his relationship with plants when he was growing up.
You can always say that good can come from bad, and so George had a lot of negatives, a lot of obstacles to the start of his life, one of them being the illness. And because of the illness, he wasn't able to go out and do heavy farm chores like most farm children would do. So Mrs. Carver kept him near her, near the house, where he learned household chores, as well as gardening and laundry and fetching the water. But he had a lot of free time on his hands, and that allowed him time to explore the woods, and he developed his observation skills, key to a scientific mind, obviously. And so as a result of his illness and his weak body at the time, he was able to go out and observe the very fine details of nature, and he especially loved plants and especially flowers. And so he developed his own little secret garden, he called it, right here on the Carver farm. And there he kept plants. Some he had transplanted from other areas. Some were sick plants. Just like him, they were sickly. And so he actually developed a nickname here. The neighborhood called him the plant doctor. And if you will, I'll just read you a small quote here. He said, "Day after day, I spent in the woods alone in order to collect my floral beauties and put them in my little garden I had hidden in the brush. Sick plants were left for treatment, and I often went to houses and prescribed for them, much as a physician prescribes for his patients." So there he is talking about his childhood development of, you know, observation and how to fix or heal sick plants. And that began, and we know later in life he was called Dr. Carver, but it started here on the farm as the plant doctor.
But as he grew, he was very, very interested in art and a talented artist as well. As he pursued education and he finally wound up in Iowa, can you tell me how he arrived at Simpson College in Indianola?
He had quite a trial finishing high school in Kansas, homesteaded for a while under the Homestead Act, and then found himself, as he called it, drifting. And he drifted and ended up in Iowa. And there he met a couple at church who brought him home, Dr. and Mrs. Milholland, who brought him home when he was living in Winterset. And he met the Milhollands, and they encouraged him, once they heard his life story and found out what had happened to him, they encouraged him to try college again, because, you see, he'd been rejected at a Kansas college based on his race. And so there he was in Iowa, and they encouraged him to attend Simpson College. He said that the people there made him believe he was a real human being. He just was accepted. He loved going to school. He was quite the student and worked really hard to pay his way. He had a really difficult time being the only African-American student there as far as finding a place to live and making some money because he was on his own in the world. But he did laundry and found places to live and pursued an art degree. I mean, he really wanted to be an artist. But his instructor there, and her name was Etta Budd, Miss Etta Budd, recognized how difficult it would be. So she, and also noticed, she recognized he was often painting landscapes and plants, lots of flowers in his paintings. So she recommended he move over to Iowa State, where her father was on staff. And so she helped him make that transition, and he went there and instead pursued a degree in agriculture. So he continued to paint all the rest of his life, and it was really an outlet for him to show nature's beauties. But that's how he ended up at Iowa State.
And when he got to Iowa State in 1891, he was the first African-American student at Iowa State University. And again, he had the same hardships of trying to find a place to live.
Oh, that's correct. It was really difficult. Early on, there were incidents of name-calling and no room in the dorm, not allowed to eat in the cafeteria. This was early on. But he was able to continue. He didn't give up. He made friends. He joined many, many different organizations, the debate club. He worked in the dairy and the equivalent of the ROTC and lots of other things that he did on campus. And he made lots of friends and became accepted. But it was a kind of a rocky start at first. But he had changed his major. His goal there was to graduate with a degree in agriculture. And so he did that with a bachelor's degree in 1894 and then stayed on and finished up his master's work in 1896. So he had a master's in agriculture and became a very well-educated man.
And he studied under Lewis Pamel, who we talked about earlier this week for his contributions to conservation. He also, Carver went on and he taught at Iowa State Agricultural College, as it was known at the time. And then later on, he went to the Tuskegee Institute. Mm-hmm. Tell me what took him there.
Booker T. Washington, the president of Tuskegee, heard about this young man. He wanted him to come to Tuskegee, which was a new school, and it was set aside for African-American education because there were so few opportunities, especially in the South, for African-American young people to find education. And so Booker T. Washington had started that school, and he was looking for the very best staff members, and he wanted George Washington Carver in the agriculture department, and he began recruiting him. And there are a series of letters that remain today between the two men where Carver was trying to decide whether or not to leave Iowa, and Iowa State did not want to let him go, but they knew that he was going to go. And when he finally accepted, he told Booker T. Washington in his letter that it had always been the one great ideal of my lifetime to be of the greatest good to the greatest number of my people possible. And so he goes on to talk about how the education he'd received was really his preparation, and now he's ready to go to work. And so he took the job, and he moved to Alabama, and he said that when he left the beautiful cornfields of Iowa and went south, he saw nothing but cotton. And he said the land looked hungry, and the people looked hungry, and everything looked hungry. And he recognized the problem right away in the agricultural work, and he was, you know, just needed to get there and get started. So he went down to Alabama, and really, it was, to me, it feels like an aha moment. It's like, okay, I have found my calling. I am going to go be of some good. I'm going to go help.
And when he looked around him in the South and he saw all that cotton and he saw the people who were struggling to make a living off the land, so many African Americans who were struggling with poor farms and worn out land and poor nutrition as well, what did he do?
So George Washington Carver got to work, first of all, addressing nutritional needs by teaching them to plant sweet potatoes because they're highly nutritious, they store well through the winter, and they'll grow in less than ideal conditions. And so he began writing his agricultural bulletins, and one of the first products he wrote about was the sweet potato, and he went into his lab and created over 100 uses for the sweet potato. So that was great. The bulletins were incredibly important. He said he wrote them as simply as possible so that the man furthest down could understand them, and he wrote them so the farmer would know how to prepare the soil and take care of the plants. He wrote them so a teacher could use them in the classroom. And he wrote the bulletins so the homemaker could preserve the food and prepare nutritious meals for the family. So obviously a humanitarian outreach from the very beginning. And then he went on to talk to the farmers about taking better care of their soil. In fact, he told them to be kind to their soil. And to do that, he taught them about beans or legumes and that they would enrich the soil. And so you would need to rotate your crops, not grow cotton every year. Well, so obviously the farmers felt kind of stuck. They didn't know what to do with peanuts if they grew a lot of them. So he went into his lab and created that famous 300 uses for the peanut. And that doesn't just include foods. He made lots of other products like plastics and papers and lots of medicinal products as well from the peanut plant. And he also outfitted the very first movable school. And this, see, Tuskegee Institute not only had students on campus, but they wanted to reach out to the families who couldn't go to school, who couldn't stop what they were doing and come to class. So they would go out and take this movable school loaded up with lots of these bulletins, new technology, different types of plows, new seed. And so this was very much an outreach. He even took his love of art with him, and he taught them how to whitewash their houses, or how to color wash is the, more the proper word, how to color wash their houses, because they were living in gray shacks, you know, sharecropper shacks. And so Carver had created over 500 colors from the Alabama clay, paints, dyes, and stains. So these 500 beautiful colors were going out on the Jessup wagon as well, and he also told the homemakers there should be a flower at every doorstep. So you see, he believed in improving your surroundings as well as your farm, and pretty soon the standard of living began to raise for the people who were in the southern agricultural environment. And the goal of Tuskegee was to help lift up these people and bring them up to where they could own their own land and be more independent. And so George Washington Carver was an important part of that work. He also did many, many other things. From the time he was in Iowa, he was cross-pollinating flowers, especially the amaryllis and the lily, and grafting cacti together and carrying generations of these same plants with him all throughout his life. He was quite the collector of, believe it or not, fungus. He sent nearly 800 specimens to the USDA, and they actually named one for him. Some of them were brand new specimens, species, and others were first time ever found in the U.S. So those observation skills he developed as a child stayed with him, and he was recognized by the scientific community as well.
He was recognized in his lifetime for his many achievements and his gifts. In 1941, Time magazine dubbed him the Black Leonardo. Do we know how he felt about all of that attention?
Well, Mr. Carver was a humble man, but I think he appreciated that attention as well. But he also felt that he had been given these opportunities to reach out to people.
Diane, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Diane Eilenstein is a park ranger at the George Washington Carver National Monument in Diamond, Missouri. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.